Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon, my radio listeners. You are getting it right with Dr. Bowles. I'm so glad to be with you this afternoon. For those of you who have followed me in the past, you will note I am on 30 minutes later than what I have in the past. I'm hoping that means that I have more of you able to catch the broadcast. And today, if you had a chance to look at the marquee, I'm very excited to have another guest with me today. If you caught me last week, I had Ms. Cassandra Bell Gash with me, and she spoke a little bit about her background and her experiences both clinically and socially here in these United States. And I am very excited to have her back for this show. As she told you in her credentials last time, she has a master's in divinity as well as in her counseling, which is her income field. Today, we're going to talk about what is social justice in United States of America. And if you had a chance to look at the marquee, I gave a bit of an academic discussion of what social justice is to give a reference as to what am I talking about and what do I mean by it. We being Cassandra and I, spoke briefly about the 14th Amendment last week, and we may touch on some other points on that as well. But those of you who are following current events, and that's how I listed this show, there is so much going on. The young man who did the shooting in Charleston, Mr. Roof, I think his name was Damien Roof, is being charged with murder with potential of a lethal injection as the consequence of the jury decision. And they did list his activity as a racial hate crime. And if you're following that in Texas, there was a shooting of a sheriff, and I think there's been a secondary shooting even after that of a law enforcement officer. And I've been hit a lot by Facebook information that here in Louisiana there has been a deputy who was pointed out as being a member of the Ku Klux Klan, and that has cost him his job. The question here is, what is social justice in the United States of America? And I say, welcome, Cassandra. How are you this afternoon?
I'm doing well, thanks, Dr. Bowles.
So, with the question on the table, what is social justice? How do you define it? What would be your response to that question?
I would infer that social justice is about equality, mutual respect, and positive regard for every individual in not just the United States, in the world, period.
Well, yeah, that's certainly a large global aspect. I'm going to bring it in a little bit more. The reason I focused on the United States, and this is a conversation I don't know if you and I have had, but I've certainly had this conversation with a number of other friends. When I look at the racial climate in the United States, and when I say racial, listeners, I'm talking Black American versus white American. I know there's been a lot of line blurring since 1964 when the civil rights movement got recognized and acknowledged, where they went from Black American or slave descendant to minorities, and then minorities began to include white women. It began to include the Filipinos and anyone of any color whatsoever that was in the United States. I personally object to that because if, as you noted in the last talk, Cassandra, the 14th Amendment is very specific. It talks about the descendants of African slaves. It did not say minorities. And the extrapolation to include all these other groups have really, in my opinion, diluted the equalization, or as they used to say, the leveling of the playing field for those who were brought in a diasporic manner. As you know, Africans were enslaved from their homeland, put in the galley of a ship, brought over, dumped out, and they are the only group in the history of man who did not have the right to have a family and raise their children. They were considered chattel slaves, which is the same as cattle, goats, chicken, pigs. They were branded. They were not allowed to have a family unit. Wives, husbands, children were sold as separate entities and property of the owner. So when I'm talking about social justice, I'm really talking about that people that was brought over 600 years ago and treated like cattle, who are now living among their previous captors and trying to be in a social dynamic. So in that context, I guess I'm not being global. I'm being very American specific. And in the climate of the shootings, whether it is a law enforcement officer just being singled out and shot, or a young black male who's put in a chokehold and strangled, I'm just trying to get some, what can I say, intelligent discussion of what is the social justice parameter here in the United States. So given that, how would you respond to what you see and how you feel of what's happening in these United States?
I think that as long as there's lack of information, lack of opportunities for relationship, this problem is going to continue to exist. And what I mean by that is I was born and raised in Cleveland County, and my hometown was Kingstown, and it was called Kingstown because it was predominantly African-American, probably 99 or 100%. And so it was named after the great Dr. Martin Luther King. And so the only time I interfaced with Caucasian society was my dad was an avid fisherman, and so I would see him interface with Caucasian society on the weekend. My first opportunity to really mingle and learn how to engage in interpersonal relationships, communicate verbally, nonverbally, was through part-time jobs and jobs that I held after college, because I went to a predominantly historically black university. So when I say that, you know, having the opportunity to be around other cultures, having the opportunity to learn, but you have to go in with something called respect and a sense of knowledge about equality and those types of things. But if you're rearing, if your previous experience don't give you that exposure, I would suggest that it's challenging, very challenging, to even interface with a society and respect issues of social justice.
Well, I know in my training, they had some social experiments where they took children of all descents, whether it was European or African or Caribbean, and from age 6 months up to 3 years, there were absolutely no kind of reaction that had an adverse indication. The darker the child, lighter the child, blonde hair, blue eyes, green eyes, brown skin, dark eyes, the children were easy to commingle. And they self-segregated, if you like, more along the age lines. You know, those that could walk went with the others who could walk, and those who could crawl stayed with the crawlers and so forth. As they got into the ages of 4 to 8, and that is considered personality building stages, this is when children imitate what they see around them. And if they were in a home where there was prejudicial discussions or any kind of caricature placement, you know, all black people steal, all black people stink, or all white people or whatever. So these children would without passively take on these beliefs and traits, and it start to be demonstrated in their commingling or isolation or segregation. So the conclusion was made that the identification of what is good, bad, or indifferent as far as social circles is really an environmental introduction. So consequently, if that's the case, and getting back to this young man, Roof, in Charleston, South Carolina, coming in, being invited into a black church congregation, sat and listened to the word, as we call it in the black churches, then opened fire, killed the minister, his sister, and 7 other people. The question would be, how do you justify that kind of thinking? He drove down from Columbia, South Carolina. And I happened to have entered the church that they were in, by the way. I lived in Charleston for a while, so I knew the exact congregation they were talking about. Go in and actually worship with the group, and then open fire and kill them. From the premise
well,
that you said.
I wouldn't suggest that his motive was to go in to worship the Father.
But he stayed for 45 minutes. He was there for 45 minutes.
Exactly. I understand, but no, he wasn't there to worship. He had a plan, and he executed that plan brutally. What you said about children development reminded me of a story that my grandmother had shared. She had worked for this Caucasian family, and the little girl, I don't remember the age, was talking about black people, and she used the N-word. And then immediately she called herself, my grandmother said, and said, "But that's not you, you're just dirty."
Well, let me tell you, that's very cogent. Also, when I was probably around 6 or 7, and since you know my family, it was a brother of mine who everyone thought was so much more brown than we are. Brother Jerry has a beautiful complexion, the complexion of my mother's father, my grandfather. And I never forget, we had some Native Americans who moved just above us in the South, especially North Carolina. People of color stayed among people of color. You know, HUD did not allow us to live among the white people in the time that I was growing up. There was no equality in FBI investigations. So you had little pockets of color in the midst of rural areas in the South. And this one young lady, a beautiful little Native American girl, would come down, and we'd interact and play. And I remember she said once to Brother Jerry, "Go wash your face." Well, we didn't think about it. He went over and he turned a faucet on, the outside faucet, and he washed his face and came back. And she stood and looked at him again and said, "Go wash your face." And she did it about 3 or 4 times until finally she says the dirt can't come off. So this was an innocent way of appraising skin of color. You know, we being people of color don't instruct our children to feel very impressed with ourselves. You know, if we were taught that brown skin is beautiful or black skin is beautiful, when someone else called it dirty, we'd be ready to argue. My skin is not dirty. It's a beautiful brown complexion. You know, I say a Hershey bar brown. But we don't teach it. It is almost as if the black American innately accepts or adopts the concept of beauty, and it excludes self. You know, all young women want their skin lighter, and they want their nose thinner, and they want the hair straighter. And all of this is divorcing or not embracing what is beautiful about us as a people.
Exactly. But one of the things that I thought was cute in the story was, number one, she enjoyed the presence of my grandmother. Number two, she had some type of conviction for the statement that she made. And then she tried to justify it by saying, "You're just dirty." And so that just kind of resonated with me, that if we didn't spend too much time looking at the outside attributes of an individual and spent time dealing with people according to their strengths, their beliefs, their capacity for opportunities, all of those things that make us a great people, we can learn from each other. And as long as we're paying attention to the outside, we are missing such a greater opportunity to intermingle and learn from one another. There are things that I have gleaned from other cultures that I really, truly admire. But because of myths, because of previous experience, it's really hard to get beyond that, to really enjoy learning who people are really about. And until we're ready to educate ourselves and be educated and be open, I think we're going to miss the mark, and we're going to continue to see these hate crimes.
Well, I think what you're saying is very applaudable and quite honorable. I mean, I would actually stand back and say the very opposite of what you are advocating is what is done. I think there is active teaching that there is an inferior race. I think there is active teaching that there is a superior race. I happen to like old movies, and somehow I tuned into something that was made in black and white, probably in the early 40s, and it showed a nanny, and it showed some history lessons. And part of what was in this movie, and I'll have to find the title so someone else can collaborate what I'm saying, the instructor was teaching this little European-born child that European children are superior, that they are the ones who colonize other countries, that they are the one who have the paradigm of beauty. This was an active lecture. This was part of history teaching. This was part of giving this child an understanding of his preservation of position in the world. When equal kinds of teaching is done in a black American sense, they call it prejudice. or they say, you know, you're teaching hate. And I'm trying to understand, how is it that I tell this child you are beautiful because your skin is brown like the earth, that you are beautiful because your hair is soft like that of a sheep or a lamb? How is that teaching hate if we teach self-love? So part of my complaint, I guess, is that, if you want to call it that, when I say social justice in the United States, is what history book, I'll challenge you, Cassandra, what history book can I go to and get good Black American history since 1615?
That I'm not sure about. I'll have to look and research and hopefully.
I can answer it. There is no book.
I would love to imagine, you know.
I'm always hopeful about those. You know why I argue? The people who write history are not Black Americans. I hear in Alexandria, Louisiana, and I'll call it out and tell it, and someone can go and challenge me and check it. When I first relocated, I like to learn about a place, and I talked to some people around, and they were telling me all kinds of stories about the 60s and the 50s, and they were touting Peabody High School as this wonderfulness. And so I thought, okay, I'm a person who checks facts. I went down to the archives here in Alexandria and went in, and a very nice gentleman, white fellow, came to me and said, may I help you? I think his name was John. He was very supportive, very respectful. And I said, yes, I'd like to get some data on lower third. And he says, we don't have anything that's listed in that way. I said, well, how about Samtown? No, I don't have anything on Samtown. Now, those terms I was using are the very language that any Black American in Alexandria will understand, because those are the neighborhoods of Black people since the 20s or maybe even 1900s. They lived in Oil City and Samtown and Lower Third. But here I was in the official documentation of the history of this city, and they had absolutely no reference to those locations. And I was so shaken by that, I went back and found the friend who's born in locally, and I said, come with me, help me out. I said, I just tried to get some data, because at the time I was on a different radio show, and I said, they told me that these places don't exist, but every time I talk to someone else, they are referencing these areas. So he went back with me. I found my curator, and we tried again, and he kept saying, no, we don't have it listed that way or this way. So the person who lived here all his life had to reference some white establishment to be able to zone in on a historical location that everybody else, people of color in this area, knew just by discussion. So this is the kind of thing when I say in an equity, how is a history of a whole group of people totally left out, no reference. The language wasn't there. Locations were not there. The person who was most helpful and willing to be supportive didn't have a clue. My friend had to say things like, oh, it's near the potato chip factory, or if you remember Mr. So-and-so owned this, it's near that. So he had to use landmarks that were white referenced in order to have locations that any Black person in the city knew, even acknowledged.
You know, and I want to quote this from Martin Luther King as well. It says, our lives begin to end the day we become silent to the things that matter. And when I wrote this down, I highlighted the word we become silent. I think it's time as African Americans, as Black folk, that we begin to create our own legacy, that we begin to no longer be silent on the issues that are important to the structure of our family, to that of our careers, that we take these opportunities that now exist and we lay new groundwork, and that we become proactive, that we have the tough talk, the tough conversation. So I commend what it is that you're doing, because these are really tough issues. These experiences happen. And sometimes it's easier to not talk about it than to talk about it. It's not that you're trying to stir up hate or that you're trying to stir up trouble, but you're trying to gain answers. You're trying to be informed and to inform. But I think that we as African Americans, as Black people, need to begin to deal with the issues at hand to promote our own growth and development. And once we've dealt with our needs for growth and development, I think we can be more to society overall. That's just my take on it, because we can't wait for someone else to make sure that they recognized us. You know, it would be nice.
It's 2 points that you make. I don't know that we've so much waited for them to recognize us, or we didn't have an opportunity to add our 2 cents worth, if you like. It wasn't until 1965 that people of color could even immigrate to the United States. A lot of people don't know that. 1776 was only a new country for European descent. It was not allowed to be a person of color. The Immigration Act prevented anybody who was not of Nordic or European descent to immigrate to the United States, and that was lifted in 1965. A lot of people don't know their history here in America. A secondary thought, and that quote was very apt, and I certainly run to that sometimes when I have to reassure myself that I'm not the only one out there bellowing in the wind. And on that same note, I'd like to shout out a salute, and anyone listening and don't know it, Mr. Keith Beauchamp from Baton Rouge, Louisiana, spearheaded, and my understanding now has been coupled with Whoopi Goldberg and others to do the Emmett Till story. Now, Emmett Till, I hope we all instantly know, he had 60-year anniversary of his assassination or murder. This was a 14-year-old Black youth who traveled from Chicago during the civil rights days. He's purported to have whistled at a white female, and for that he was kidnapped from a home and bludgeoned and beaten beyond recognition. And Mr. Beauchamp was instrumental with others to get this case reopened through United Nations appeal. They did finally make an arrest. I think it was like an 83-year-old person arrested for this young man's murder. And now Mr. Beauchamp is coming with a movie. And my understanding is some of the shooting has begun, or filming has begun, in the Delta, and they're looking to release it within the next 18 months to 2 years. And I think that is certainly applaudable, that this is a Black American initiative. This is certainly seemingly a predominantly Black American-supported production. And it's a story that must be told. It's not one that just needs to be told. It must be told. It's very important, as you point out, Cassandra, that we have the hard discussions. And there's always those who say, oh, let bygones be bygones, turn the other cheek, and so forth. And I'm not against any of that. But I stand firm to say, before any cheeks are turned, at least get the facts. That too often we repeat what hasn't been verified. And often if the story is told with any kind of a skew, we swallow it. We take what is said and run with it. And my advocacy is, if it's really a fact, it'll stand up to anybody's scrutiny. That I don't have to change it because Cassandra's looking at it. If I said it and you look at it and see something different, you should see what I see, or at least your perspective should not be 180 different. It should stand for itself.
Exactly, exactly. I understand that statement, and to a large degree, I agree with it. I think that what we need to do is set expectations, you know, expectations of justice, you know, those fair, equal practices that African Americans want. You know, I want a fair shot. I want a fair opportunity. I don't want to worry about, is someone going to look at my name? You know, I had a relative who recently had a baby, and I was tickled because the name was very generic. It wasn't a name that you could see the name and identify the race of the child. And I'm seeing that trend amongst African-American professionals, because there's this belief, good, bad, or indifferent, that we are often screened out by our name on a resume before our credentials are even looked upon. So everything that you're saying is true, it's a lie. I am always hopeful, but the reality is that we still have a long ways to go.
Okay, well, I'm smiling as you said that, because I actually attend something called Spoken Word, and I'll do a shout-out for the Alexandria Museum of Art. Every fourth Friday They have a very well-organized Black American activity, predominantly Black American. We have a couple of non-Black Americans, but this has sort of been embraced largely by the Black American community, and they call it spoken word. And when you were talking about the, I would just say, Ebonics or the ghettoization of names, the host of the spoken word is a very, very, very talented poet. And she did a long oral report. If you're familiar with spoken word, it's kind of like a slam. That's what it used to be called. Mine, the first introduction was Nikki Giovanni, and that tells my age, and I don't care. It's a kind of rhythmic poem that's an epic. It tells a story. It's the old world kind of ballad. Well, in one of her ballad poems, she talked about how, and I'll quote her, the ghetto mother uses too many alphabets in naming her children, but that might be all she has to give them. And I thought that was very funny because we have these complicated three-syllable, oftentimes hyphenated, apostrophized names which identify that they are Black Americans, usually coming from a low socioeconomic background. And you were very kind in saying purportedly they are discriminated against. I can tell you conclusively they are. When I worked for industry like Westinghouse, when I've worked in other kinds of very white American institutions, they did look at the name, and the names were screened, and they did, without any embarrassment or any kind of hesitation, place a file that had a three-syllable, odd-spelling, apostrophe, hyphenated name to one side. So I don't have to guess. I don't have to be gentle in my walking through that comment. I was there. I saw it. And some of the people react by saying, perhaps, and again, this came out in spoken word, one of the persons said, perhaps the names that we are generating out of the ghetto setting are remnants of our real African tongue, that if you study any kind of articulation or speech, the African language has that kind of rolling, guttural, multi-syllabic emphasized words. They go cook and cook and go, much more than English does. And if you look at these names, it forces some of those clicking and clucking and swallowing sounds. And they were suggesting that perhaps through the ages, despite our dehumanization and despite our integration, there are remnants of what came with us from the jungles, from the native country continent, Africa, that are now manifesting in some of the names that we are giving our children. But like you, I am seeing the yuppie, if you like, the young, upward mobile, Black American professional naming their children these very generic things. You know, in my own family, I think we have a Colin, and we have a Naya, and a Zula. And I'm saying, wow, where are these names coming from? But it could be, as you suggest, an effort to come back mid-center or swing a little bit to the far left. But
the impetus for that is there is a fear that there will be lack of opportunity if they will name something that identifies their culture.
That's what social justice is about.
Leveling the playing field.
Yes, yes. Well, what your last statement reflects very poignantly how we are sensitive to how things are not socially just. That if your name identifies me as a Black female, that before you ever see my work, before you ever interview me, you take my folder and you lay it to one side, not to be among those that are invited for that interview.
When I see these things, I'm just always left with the probing question, what's up with that? You know, what's up with that? I'm looking for answers. I'm looking for people to just speak their opinion and not be afraid to voice, you know, their thoughts. We don't have to always agree. We're not going to always agree, but I think the conversation needs to exist, because what's up with that? When do we get that? thinking. It was because of something that happened to us or a story that we heard. Why are we altering what we want to do?
Just well, it sounds like to me, Cassandra, that we have to continue this conversation, and we may just have our next one call What's Up With That. We are now at the end of our 30 minutes, and I thank you so much for your joining me today, both my radio listeners and Ms. Cassandra. I do look forward to the next time that you join me. So until then, I say take care, everybody.
Bye-bye.